Hi, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, August 1st, 2017.
On staffing, how would you run a government to make it more effective? What would be your criteria in choosing the senior administrators?
Track record, great competence, love of what they're doing, how they're getting along with people, references. I mean, no different than when you're running a company, how you hire top people. It would be no different.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillich, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And what you just heard there was candidate Donald Trump answering questions from a hedge fund manager, John Paulson, at a Q&A before the election. But getting and keeping people of great competence, as the president says, seems to be harder for the Trump administration. At least 10 administration officials have resigned or been fired since President Trump took office. They include the National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, the FBI Director, James Comey, the Press Secretary, Sean Spicer, and also four communications directors since the transition. The latest, Anthony Scaramucci. He's out after just 10 days on the job. On Monday, new White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders tried to account for Scaramucci's sudden firing.
The president certainly felt that Anthony's comments were inappropriate for a person in that position, and he didn't want to burden General Kelly also with that line of succession.
She's talking there about General John Kelly, once the Secretary of Homeland Security and now the newly minted White House Chief of Staff, after another high-profile departure from Reince Priebus, who left after the shortest stint as Chief of Staff in American history. It seems like no one is safe. Is this just how the boss wants it? Or is President Trump ready or even able to impose order on a chaotic White House? Rosie Gray is White House correspondent for The Atlantic, and she joins me now, along with Chris Whipple. He's author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Rosie, Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Rosie, let's start with you. Anthony Scaramucci, as I mentioned, is out as communications director, only 10 days on the job. Was this Kelly's doing, his first action as White House press secretary? A lot of reporting suggested that the president was quite pleased with what Anthony Scaramucci was doing, eviscerating other members of the senior staff in the press until the headlines didn't go away and the story lasted longer than he'd wanted.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a little bit of retroactive spin that, you know, the president, you know, thought that his comments to the New Yorker were inappropriate and all this stuff. And I think it's less that the president was offended by what Scaramucci told the New Yorker, the by now famous comments about Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon that were said in very colorful language. And it's more that I think the constant news cycles that ensued became a distraction. In terms of John Kelly, I mean, yeah, this is a new chief of staff sort of coming in and flexing his muscles a little bit. My understanding is that, you know, he was sworn in as chief of staff and basically soon afterwards fired Scaramucci.
Rosie, a lot of people around Washington, just to put it plainly, are wondering what is John Kelly thinking. He was over at Homeland Security. He was doing very well. The president seems to like him. And he may be entering a hornet's nest now where nobody can seem to last in a job.
Right. You know, there's a reason why the Trump White House has had trouble hiring, and it's because when you're serving in there, you become part of this sort of endless palace intrigue and drama and chaos that has characterized this White House pretty much from the beginning. In terms of what John Kelly's motivation is, I don't think that that's entirely clear. But around town, I mean, you know, people are saying that they don't think that he would have really taken this job without certain assurances that he'll be empowered to be a real chief of staff in a way that Reince Priebus never really was. So the first thing that has happened is that, you know, there is now more of sort of a chain of command, they say. Yesterday in the press briefing, Sarah Sanders said that John Kelly was going to basically be the person that everybody else reports to before the president, whereas before, some of the senior staffers were able to sort of have direct access to the president.
Chris, what do you see in General Kelly's appointment as White House Chief of Staff? What signals do you think the president is sending here, bringing this general in from Homeland Security? Or is there no signal and Kelly is just someone untainted who the president trusts and who's willing to take the job?
Well, the key thing is, does it mean that Donald Trump has actually learned something from 6 months of governing? It's not clear that he has. But, you know, back in December when I wrote the epilogue for my book, The Gatekeepers, I said that if Trump tried to govern the way he campaigned, you know, based on half-baked information and just on his gut that this would be a disaster. And if he didn't empower a White House chief of staff to execute his agenda, he wouldn't get anything done. That's where we are. You know, Priebus was never empowered to do the job. And it's exponentially more challenging than anything John Kelly has done in his life. And he's done a lot of things, but he's got to be able to not only be empowered as first among equals in the White House to execute Trump's agenda, but most importantly, he has to be the guy who walks into the Oval Office, closes the door, and tells Donald Trump what he doesn't want to hear. If he can't do that, then this will fail.
Is that what history tells us about chiefs of staff and their relationship with the president?
There's no question about it. The gold standard, I think everybody would agree, was James A. Baker III under Ronald Reagan. And I would put Leon Panetta right up there with him under Bill Clinton. Those two guys were grounded. They were experienced. They had nothing to prove. They were comfortable in their own skin. They could walk into the Oval Office and tell Reagan or Clinton, in Panetta's case, hard truths. Nobody has been able to do that with Donald Trump. Reince Priebus was really the sycophant in chief, and it's a West Wing populated by enablers. So that's going to be the real test for Kelly going forward.
Rosie Gray, you hear what Chris Whipple is saying there about the ability to walk into the Oval Office and give it straight to a president. But for that to work, Rosie Gray, there has to be a president who's willing to act on that advice or even listen to it. I'm not sure that's who Donald Trump has been so far.
Well, right. I mean, I think that's kind of the issue. You know, even if he is given good advice, he doesn't always take it. He wants to do what he wants to do. There are probably, at this point, many people who have advised him maybe to not tweet so much. Particularly, you know, I don't think Republicans on the Hill have been super thrilled about his Twitter habit, but he still does it all the time. So I don't think, I mean, you know, this sort of semi-narrative that has taken hold that, you know, John Kelly is going to come in there and kind of professionalize the operation and, like, things might sort of become normal. I mean, you have to remember that it's still Donald Trump who's the president. The culture within the White House is set from the top. And at the end of the day, he's going to do what he himself wants to do.
You know, in the moments after Reince Priebus was fired and John Kelly was appointed, a lot of people in Washington were going on television, going on the radio, asking this question, whether John Kelly can bring order to the West Wing. Is there evidence now that the president wants order? He seems at times to be all right with chaos, at least in the first 6 months.
Well, it seems to me the encouraging first step was getting rid of Scaramucci, who is a guy who should never have been within 100 miles of a functioning White House to begin with. So that's encouraging. What it shows, I think, is that so far Kelly at least has been empowered as the guy through whom everybody in the West Wing has to report. But now comes the really hard part. You know, this is a White House that's completely broken. It can't do anything right. It can't issue executive orders that are enforceable. It can't pass legislation. It can't prioritize the president's agenda, which is completely unclear. And it can't get anybody on the same page. In a functioning White House, all of this flows from an empowered White House chief. So that's for openers. The real test will be disciplining Donald Trump. I'm skeptical that that can happen, but you know, Kelly has to try. And I would begin by drawing, I think Kelly should draw some red lines. Every successful White House chief has been ready to resign if necessary. And I think Kelly needs to make it clear to Trump, for example, if you're not going to let me approve your tweets in advance, if you tweet something that is demonstrably false, I will resign. And you will be looking for White House chief number three.
So far, there hasn't been much of an indication, really, that order is something that Donald Trump wants around him. I mean, I think he sort of enjoys pitting his aides against each other. He enjoys sort of there being people sort of competing for his attention. And that has contributed to this atmosphere within the West Wing of sort of mutual suspicion and factionalism between different aides. I would say, like, the one sort of encouraging sign in terms of more order in the White House would be the fact that, you know, that Kelly was allowed to come in and you know, make a pretty important personnel decision right off the bat, which was firing Anthony Scaramucci, which is something that Reince Priebus obviously was not able to do during the 10 days that, first of all, he wasn't able to stop him from being hired, and then was not able to sort of best him in that, you know, 10-day-long sort of war that they had. But no, I mean, I don't think, I would not get too excited about John Kelly as some sort of bringer of order until we've seen him in the job for a little bit more time.
Well, and also, if I can add to that, the precedent here is not encouraging. The last general to serve as White House chief was Al Haig under Gerry Ford after Richard Nixon resigned in disgrace. And Haig lasted a little bit more than a month. One of the reasons he couldn't manage the White House was because Gerry Ford had a model that was very similar to Donald Trump's, with advisors coming and going from the Oval Office and no real chain of command. And he called it the spokes of the wheel, with Ford at the center. It was a disaster. So within a month, Ford was begging his old pal Don Rumsfeld to come in and whip the White House into shape, which Rumsfeld did when he was empowered by Ford.
And in this situation, since you're comparing it to the Ford administration, even if John Kelly is the gatekeeper and brings order to access to the Oval Office, in this White House, senior advisors like the president's daughter and son-in-law still get to see him every night in the family residence.
It's a really, really tough challenge. It may be mission impossible when you consider all of those factors. You know, on the other hand, think of, it's not the first time we've had a White House riven by, internecine warfare and ideological battles. I mean, the Reagan White House was a zoo, as Reagan famously called it. And James Baker prevailed because he was savvy enough to make the right alliances. He made Nancy Reagan an ally. He made Michael Deaver, the deputy chief, who was like a son to Reagan, an ally. And then when the hard right factions came after Jim Baker, the pragmatist, he prevailed.
Chris Whipple, author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, and Rosie Gray, White House correspondent for The Atlantic. Thank you both for being here.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, Obamacare repeal is stalled. Meanwhile, more Democrats think it's time to consider what other countries do. We've been asking you, would you ever support single-payer health care?
This is Andrew calling from The Colony, Texas. No, simply put, people have a right to choose their level of care and cost. The opportunity for fiduciary duty to override our right to choose is just too great.
This is Ian from Maui. And yes, I would support a single-payer healthcare system. Overall, it's cheaper and makes everyone healthier to have access to treatments and preventative medicine. And everyone needs healthcare at some point in their life, like as they come into this world and as they go out of it, which we all do.
Democrats want to bring this idea in from the fringes. What do you think about single-payer? Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always send your tweets at The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Here's Montana Republican Senator David Daines last week on the Senate floor as his party struggled to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Some call it government-run health care. Some call it single-payer health care. Some call it Medicare for all. But in essence, it's socialized medicine.
Now, Daines dared Democrats to vote for single-payer health care during that debate. None of them took the bait, but that's not because a lot of them don't like the idea. Single-payer used to be a fantasy of the leftists in Congress. Bernie Sanders always has been into it. But a new Pew poll out last month found that 6 in 10 Americans now support the idea. Listen to Democratic Senator and possible future presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren.
So if we're talking about tearing down the healthcare system and starting over, then I think every option needs to be on the table, and single payer sure ought to be at the top of the list.
You can hear Elizabeth Warren through the cameras there. Single payer ought to be at the top of the list, she says. And some Democrats now look at wages and the economy, and they think it's time to bring this maligned idea of socialized medicine from the political fringes to the center. Adam Gaffney is a physician and instructor at Harvard Medical School. He serves on the board of directors of Physicians for a National Health Program. He supports single-payer health care, and he joins me now. Adam Gaffney says there are a few reasons why many Democrats see the idea as more realistic than they have in the past.
First of all, somewhat paradoxically, the resistance against Trump care has really activated the citizenry and made people think about health care, I think, to some extent in a new way. We saw activism from coast to coast. We saw people calling into their senators and their congressmen. We saw people marching in the Capitol. And really, I think there's been a moral framing about health care that has emerged from the debate over Trump care. The idea that health care is a right, I think, has become actually only strengthened by the successful resistance against the Obamacare repeal.
Still, an idealism and a passion for Medicare for all or for single payer is one thing. Liberals are operating, of course, in an environment with a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and the White House, but more importantly, an environment where Democrats have lost 1,000 seats in legislatures across the 50 states. It's nice to have the passion, but it doesn't look like the kind of environment where this is real.
Well, I would agree with you. The political odds are against the movement at the moment, the way the balance of power is currently is. That being said, things change, and that is going to change. And support among Democrats for Medicare for All is rising. We now see that more than half of House Democrats have signed on to a single-payer bill. And then in the general population, even putting aside, as you said, liberals, in the general population, support for single-payer is also rising. Kaiser Family Foundation polls show that support was at 40% for single-payer in the late 1990s. Now a majority of the nation supports single payer. So I think this is going to be an issue that Democrats won't be able to turn away from in coming years. In fact, I think it's going to be very difficult to be a Democratic politician and not sign on to Medicare for All.
Well, that's important because we've seen an election, of course, where Senator Bernie Sanders gave Hillary Clinton a very tough time in the primary. We all know that. But they sort of each represent these two different minds of healthcare when it comes to Democrats. And now in the post-election world, players like Elizabeth Warren has said she's for single payer. Kamala Harris of California is for it. And there seems to be an effort now among high-profile Democrats to move this idea toward the center of the party.
That's exactly right. I think it is really becoming a policy position that's going to be difficult for Democrats who want to be successful to not get behind. You know, I think another factor that's important to point out here is also just the facts on the ground in terms of the healthcare system. You know, the Affordable Care Act, which has survived, did many good things, covered 20 million more people, but it has still left the main problems of the U.S. healthcare system in place. And as long as that's the case, this isn't going away. The two biggest ones are really uninsurance. 28.6 million people remained uninsured in 2016. And then an underinsurance, the seemingly inexorable rise of deductibles. And as copayments and deductibles go up, people can't necessarily afford to go to the doctor, to the hospital, fill an asthma medication prescription, or what have you. And as long as uninsurance and underinsurance remain pernicious problems in the U.S. healthcare system, we're not going to see the fight for universal healthcare fade anytime soon.
It also seems like those parts of the healthcare system that you're talking about, Doctor, are one conversation in a broader economic moment in the United States. I mean, wages have been stagnant, we know that, rising healthcare costs, even the future of work, where the rise of artificial intelligence has a lot of people warning that there will be fewer jobs out there, and that means fewer people can get their health coverage through work, all seems to be contributing, it seems to me, to a grander sense that people's healthcare security is going to be at risk in the future even more than it is now.
I would agree. I think that the movement for universal health care is one movement that's part of a much larger movement towards more justice in economic spheres and in social spheres. And the other thing I think that's really going to continue to push this forward and keep Medicare for All in center stage is that in many respects, it's really the only option left.
Let's talk about the other big reality of single-payer health care. How big would the tax increase be to pay for it?
First of all, we are talking about replacing current healthcare spending. So even if your taxes go up somewhat under a single payer, if your premiums disappear and your deductibles disappear, you may or very likely will come out ahead. And that is a critical point that we're going to hammer over and over and over again, because your overall well-being will improve under single payer, in my opinion, despite the fact that there will be new taxes to pay for it. I'm not going to give a tax number right now, because it's still very much under debate. It's still very much under discussion. But the broader issue here is that we're already spending so much more than other countries with single payer systems. And so there's no reason that we can't, at the very least, spend no more in terms of overall healthcare spending. And we're going to divide the costs of healthcare more fairly. Less when you're sick, less when you need to go to the doctor, and more on people with higher incomes who can afford to contribute more to the system.
There is a political party in this country that has a lot of control that exists pretty much for one reason, and it's to cut taxes, not raise them.
You know, that party may be shooting itself in its foot as we speak. Let's be honest, politics change. And when the discourse around an issue shifts entirely, you can have a change in the overall political paradigm. I think we're already seeing that. I think that Americans could certainly get behind a program that gives universal health care, covers everybody, people never have to worry about dealing with medical bills ever again. Those are really popular ideas, and I think that they'd be willing to accept a tax increase in order to pay for it.
Dr. Adam Gaffney, physician and instructor at Harvard Medical School and on the board of Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Gaffney, thank you.
It was a real pleasure.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. They're electing a new interim prime minister in Pakistan's parliament today, all because the sitting prime minister, Nawaz Sharif, was ousted late last week. Sharif was forced to resign by the Supreme Court over finances that the court said he failed to disclose. Now, the resignation of a prime minister is not uncommon in Pakistan. In fact, it's the rule, not the exception. No prime minister in Pakistan has ever finished a full term. Nawaz Sharif has now been prime minister on three separate occasions and has resigned or been removed from office each time. Omar Warich is here on this latest resignation in Pakistan. He's a foreign correspondent. His writings have appeared in Time, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic. Omar, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
Nawaz Sharif isn't accused of any crimes or abuse of power here. So how does the court justify disqualifying him?
Right. So there hasn't been a trial for conviction and he hasn't been prosecuted a conviction. What the court did was they said after, you might remember something called the Panama leaks, the Panama Papers.
Of course.
This is where documents from a law firm in Central America were leaked. And Nawaz Sharif was one of the most prominent people named in there. As a result of that, there was a huge uproar in Pakistan, and the Supreme Court took action and said to Nawaz Sharif, you have to demonstrate the source of your wealth. So they asked him to do that. An investigation took place, and the investigation concluded that he had not satisfactorily disclosed his wealth. He had an election form on which he said he owned certain properties, but hadn't included a source of income he got from Dubai. And as a result, the court decided that he wasn't morally upright, that he wasn't truthful and trustworthy. And using a morality clause, they disqualified him from office.
Well, if Nawaz Sharif isn't morally upright by these legal standards, Omar, he's been prime minister three times. That would suggest he could go for a fourth, I suppose. Does not being morally upright stick with you as a stigma, or is it a one-time thing for this stint as prime minister?
This is a very vague and overbroad clause in the Pakistani constitution. It was brought in by an Islamizing military ruler, General Zia-ul-Haq, during the 80s. And what he tried to say was that you have to be a pious Muslim to be able to hold public office. The exacting standards of the morality clause are such that if consistently applied, no one in the Pakistani parliament would pass. The parliament would be empty. So this is the first time the court has resorted to this measure. It could be used against anyone for any reason. It's that vague.
So how are voters reacting to all of this? Is this just humdrum? Another prime minister resigns, you move on?
Well, in a way, they're used to it because, I mean, ever since Pakistan's first prime minister was assassinated in 1948, it's either been the assassin, the judge, or the general who's decided their fate and not the voter. So there are mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, there is a overwhelmingly young population which fears for its own prospects, which worries about the attitudes of its rulers, and they want to see the people they regard as inept, distant, and venal elites held accountable. At the same time, there are huge questions about what will it take for Pakistan to get stability. Next week, Pakistan will be celebrating the 70th year of its independence. That's a long time to be a country. And it's a very long time to not have a stable political system where voters can vote in someone and then vote them out again.
A populist Supreme Court in Pakistan brings down another prime minister. Foreign correspondent Omar Warich, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Vice President Mike Pence is on a foreign tour, and a lot of it seems to be about Russia. Pence made a stop in the Baltic states yesterday to reassure those tiny countries that the U.S. has their back if Russia gets aggressive. Now the vice president is in Georgia.
At this very moment, just 40 miles from where we stand, Russian tanks stand on occupied territory in South Ossetia. Today, Russia continues to occupy one-fifth of Georgian territory.
That's Mike Pence in Tbilisi, the Georgian capital. Today, the vice president meets with the Georgian president and attends military drills being conducted as a show of force against Russia. Lincoln Mitchell spent some time working in Georgia. He's also the author of Uncertain Democracy, U.S. Foreign Policy, and Georgia's Rose Revolution. He's currently an associate research scholar at Columbia University and just got back from Georgia. Lincoln, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we heard some of the vice president's words there in Georgia. Russia occupies two major provinces of Georgia. So why this reassurance tour now?
Well, first, what we heard vice president say is exactly the American talking point that the Georgians wanted to hear. Those words could have come out of the mouth of Vice President Joe Biden, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, or John Kerry, or anybody in the Bush administration. The difference is that Donald Trump is the president now, and Donald Trump has sent what could be generously described as very mixed signals on Russia. If you're sitting in Tbilisi right now and you're sitting in the government, you're worried. What is Russia's relationship with the U.S.? What is Trump's real relationship with Putin? And Mike Pence is there to say everything is okay. Whether or not everything is okay, we'll see in the coming months and years.
So Mike Pence is really delivering the traditional American message to a former Soviet satellite, and really the traditional Republican message, too, of get tough on Russia, even if that's not always coming from the top.
Yes, although right now it's more or less a bipartisan message. That doesn't sound too different than what Joe Biden, who of course is a Democrat, said when they were there. The difference is the context. And that's something that the Georgians are really wrestling with and really concerned about.
So Georgia is bidding to join NATO, Lincoln, and NATO expansion is a huge irritant for Vladimir Putin in Russia. Is Putin likely to see this trip by Pence and the speeches as significant pushback?
I don't know that he sees it as significant pushback, but he certainly would be disappointed. Putin is learning that regardless of the relationship between Russia and Donald Trump, he's not getting what he wants from the United States right now. And part of that is because countries like Georgia, like Ukraine, like the Baltic states have a lot of allies in Washington. So just having a new president doesn't change anything. Mike Pence, traditional Republican ally, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, and the Republicans in Congress. But interestingly, Putin's intervening in our election has made hawks out of the Democrats as well. So you probably have a stronger anti-Russia consensus in Congress, bipartisan consensus, than any time in recent years because of what Putin did in our election.
If Vladimir Putin isn't getting what he wants out of the new American administration, would you expect other irritants? Would you expect him to escalate in countries like Georgia or the Baltics?
I don't know that he would escalate in Georgia or the Baltics. And the reason particularly in Georgia is that Russia already occupies, for lack of a better word, about a fifth of Georgian territory, as the vice president said. That is an enormous problem for Georgia. We talk a lot about Abkhazia, which is one of the territories, but the second territory is South Ossetia, which is really a stone's throw from the capital. And there is a lot of Russian military hardware there, and that is very disruptive for Georgia. So he doesn't need to send tanks into Tbilisi to accomplish more than what he wants. The question I would raise is, if he doesn't get what he wants from the Trump administration, what does he do to leverage his relationship with Trump? And we can't answer that because we don't know the depths of that relationship. We don't know the financial relationship. We don't know if there is any compromise. But if there is, he may play those cards more in the coming weeks and months, and that would be extremely disruptive to the Trump presidency, which is already having a very hard time functioning like anything approaching a normal presidency, and it would be very disruptive to the political life of the United States more generally.
Lincoln Mitchell, author of Uncertain Democracy, U.S. Foreign Policy, and Georgia's Rose Revolution. Lincoln Mitchell, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting The Incredible Jessica James, a new romantic comedy starring Jessica Williams and Chris O'Dowd, now streaming on Netflix.
I'm Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway. As a complicated and messy immigration fight drags on in this country, immigration detention is costing billions. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, spent more than $3 billion in 2016 dealing with immigrants facing deportation. Now, part of that figure is a quota first passed by Congress in 2009. It requires no less than 33,400 immigration detention beds to be active every single night. That number is even higher today. Congressman Bill Foster has been a Democratic congressman from Illinois' 11th congressional district since 2012 and the 14th district from 2008 until 2011. And he's been trying to eliminate that detention bed mandate for years.
The situation arose actually during the Bush administration when they started to apprehend a large number of, you know, undocumented immigrants and then, however, did not have the money to house them. So that caused a problem, and the solution that Congress came up with at that time was to say that we have to preserve a minimum number of beds no matter what. There are a number of much less expensive alternatives to detaining immigrants than, you know, locking them up somewhere. It costs roughly $150 per person per day to put them in a detention facility for, you know, roughly a tenth of that, somewhere between $17 and 15 cents, 20 cents a day. You can put them into either electronic monitoring programs or community-based programs where people are simply frequently monitored as to where they are. Also, if you use a little bit of sense about which immigrants have a high risk of flight, then you can save the government a lot of money. But we don't do that when we have the sort of mindless policy that says 34,000 beds no matter what. That also generates a big incentive to get the beds filled, particularly by the for-profit detention centers.
Well, what kind of evidence have you seen that 34,000 is the right number, that if you cut it down to 8,000, you would be damaging the public interest or missing out on law and order?
Well, there are two different adjustments you can make. One is to simply adjust the number of beds you have ready unconditionally. Beds are a sort of loose term that includes both space in local county jails that's used. There are federal facilities used specifically for detention centers, and there are also for-profit private detention centers, which are I think in a recent year, roughly 12% of all detainees are kept in these for-profit institutions. The Obama administration had announced a policy of phasing these out because what happens in the for-profit institutions is that you find the standard of care that they have contracted for is something that they do not always follow. The for-profit prisons tend to they pay less, so they hire out of a different application pool, and they have very high turnover. More than half of the guards at for-profit centers turn over in any given year. And that doesn't generate a very well-trained force, and a lot of bad things happen to detainees in that circumstance. There was an instance, for example, when the contract was actually terminated by the Department of Justice because a facility had, you know, reports of questionable deaths and very substandard medical care. And so, unfortunately, of course, when the Trump administration came in, they reversed many of these decisions and have now reactivated the contract from the very firm that had it, had the contract revoked for unsafe conditions for detainees.
Still, only 12% of the total detainee population you're quoting here goes to the private prison companies, which suggests that their lobbying for the money, which I'm sure that they want, is only a very small part of the problem here. There's lots of public money flowing downstream to local jails as well.
Correct. You know, if I were to design the system, I would look much more carefully at the extent to which there's a real flight risk. ICE right now uses a three-tiered approach based largely on degrees of criminality to estimate the flight risk. But, you know, there are other things you can look at that give you a much better idea of whether the person really needs to be detained compared to just given a court date. There's another very effective way of saving the government money, which is simply to provide immigrant detainees what are called a legal orientation. And that means it's simply a lecture given in a language they can understand, which is often an important issue, explaining the basics of immigration law and the possible ways that you could appeal a detention and deportation. Only about 10% of all immigration facilities provide these, and the ones that do have substantially lower costs per detainee, because in many cases, perhaps even most, there isn't a realistic chance of staying around to appeal through the court system and have your deportation order overturned. And so under these circumstances, the detainees often say, okay, I'm not going to fight this in the court. Many fewer days are spent in the federal facilities. This, of course, saves the taxpayer a lot of money, but reduces the profits of the for-profit prisons. And so it's had a very difficult time getting traction.
Well, that does make me wonder, Congressman, for the more rational approach that you see to this policy, what kind of pushback do you get from your colleagues when you tell them, hey, we could save your constituents lots of money, the taxpayer, less bureaucracy? Lots of members of Congress like to hear about those things. Is it just law and order? Is it a sense among constituents that they want people locked up? What causes this system to perpetuate when you have a more rational approach?
Well, it's one of the most heartbreaking classes of conversations I have, and I have this in a number of subjects, discussions with my Republican colleagues, when they acknowledge that, you know, there is a correct and rational position on things, you know, like climate change or a rational policy toward immigrant detention. And then they say, you know, you're right on this, but I just can't vote that way in my district. Or I would get a primary challenge from the right if I acknowledged what I believe to be the correct and rational positions on things. You know, for example, we've only once been successful in having a vote on the floor of the House for an amendment to strike the detention bed. I think it was in 2013. And we did get Republican votes for that. But it is a very tough vote for a number of Republicans because on one hand, you're voting for something that sort of objectively looking at it wastes government money, which is not something they normally are big fans of. But on the other hand, if you vote to get rid of the detention bed mandate, that opens you up to the attack of being, you know, soft on immigration, which unfortunately, you know, has a lot more teeth in a Republican primary than it does in the rest of the general electorate.
Attempts at an alternative approach to immigrant detention from Congressman Bill Foster of the 11th District in Illinois. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and here's a little quiz. It's really easy. Name one thing that your mother or father cooked for you when you were a little kid.
Peanut butter and lettuce sandwiches.
Sunday breakfast my mother used to make, consisting of ackee and saltfish with cornmeal dumplings.
Now think of one thing that grandma cooked for you.
My maternal grandmother was famous in the family for many dishes, but her latkes were number one.
There are lots of ways that we share family memories down through the generations. We tell stories, we take pictures, but food is one of the most important. My grandmother told stories all the time, but to this day, we still eat her recipes when we sit down at the holidays. Food, of course, is part of the flavor of our lives, just like it was for our parents. We've asked you, and you've been sharing some of the flavors from your lives with us.
Hey guys, this is Deb from Holiday. I'm German from Minnesota. So scalloped potatoes with ham and also sautéed potatoes with onions. both totally heart healthy.
This is Daryl Rojas calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. And my comment is cornbread, good old Birmingham cornbread made in the black skillet pot. Ain't had that since Grandma passed away in 96.
Oh, man, it all sounds so good, except maybe the peanut butter and lettuce sandwiches, I have to say. But now our friend Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, is launching a new four-part series. It's called Your Mom's Food, and it's all about culture and food traditions that get passed down or sometimes get lost through the generations. The series kicks off with a look at how parents of adopted kids from other countries use food to try to make cultural connections, and it doesn't always go how they'd hoped. Dan Pashman, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about the new series.
Well, as you said, it's called Your Mom's Food, and you know, it's really about the complications that can come up when we try to pass our culture on from one generation to another. In the first episode, we look at the issue of adoption. In some of the later episodes, we talk about what happens when two people from very different backgrounds get married and have to figure out what kind of food is going to be their food. What happens when one of the people maybe feels like they gave up more than the other? And then what do they feed their kids? And these are really kind of universal questions when families grow and evolve over time and as traditions get passed down or get lost.
Well, everybody eats, and you've been spending time hanging out with a bunch of families of adoptive children from other countries, as I mentioned. What did you find out?
Well, I mean, we especially wanted to use this issue to look at some complicated questions of race and culture. And so in the first episode, I spent some time with a group of families who are all single moms who've adopted kids from Ethiopia. Ethiopia recently barred international adoption because of issues with fraud. But for a long time, Ethiopia was the only country that would let single parents adopt. And so you have these groups, this group on Long Island that I hung out with, of moms who get together with their kids once a month, and they often will cook Ethiopian food. Even though none of the parents are from anywhere in Africa, they are trying to learn to cook Ethiopian food because they want to help their adopted kids connect with their birthplace. And food is a really powerful way to do that. You know, in a previous generation, the prevailing wisdom around adoption was often that you wanted to try to, if you adopt a kid from another country, you wanted to try to assimilate them into your family as much as possible. And that led to a lot of, I mean, I'm generalizing a bit here, obviously, but that led to a lot of hurt feelings and even whitewashing, which I think the current wisdom around international adoption is moving in another direction.
Well, you spoke to one woman named Mary who adopted two Ethiopian girls. Now, she went and met their birth mother, and here's what she had to say.
When I spoke to their mother, I felt guilty that I was taking somebody's children, I think. The biggest promise was to send the letters and the pictures, but I also felt, you know, she gave me such a big gift that it was important for me to, you know, return that to her and to make sure that these girls really felt, that, you know, knew where they came from and appreciated it.
Dan Pashman, there's Mary talking about part of the reason why she was cooking Ethiopian food for her girls.
So Mary has two daughters. They're 11 and 13 now, Diknesh and Tikdem, and they had a culture day in their school recently, and they brought in Ethiopian honey bread. And Mary also printed out pictures of Ethiopia to send in with the girls. And the girls were excited about the honey bread, but they were not quite so excited about the pictures.
I wasn't really nervous about bringing in the bread so much, but like my mom had printed out pictures of like African culture and like pictures of what it's like there, and I was just like, I don't want to bring this in. I didn't want her to make it at all, but she still made it.
One of the challenges that we talk a little bit about in this first episode of this Sporkful series is that these two girls are the only Ethiopian or African kids in their school. There aren't that many people of color at all in their school district, and so, you know, that's something that Mary worries about, Mary, their mother, and that's, you know, it's, in some ways, these are universal parenting questions. In some ways, this is unique to their situation.
You also spent some time with some adult children who had been adopted from Korea.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Todd. So there was a huge influx of Korean adoptees to America over a period of about 60 years, actually the largest adoption exodus from one country in history from the 1950s up until about a decade ago. And as a result, because so many Korean adoptees came to America, these Korean culture camps sprung up around the country. And these are places where a family that had adopted kids from Korea might go for a week in the summertime, the whole family, and learn about Korean culture. And a big part of that would be Korean food. They would make mandu, Korean dumplings. They'd have japchae, glass noodles. And as part of the series, we spoke with two adult Korean adoptees who grew up going to these culture camps, connecting with Korean food in a somewhat similar way that these Ethiopian kids today are connecting with their heritage. And yet those adult Korean adoptees, when they left home, got older, they still felt like it wasn't enough. They had still felt like they had more questions than answers.
I think I always sensed that, like, the food at that camp was dumbed down for, like, an American palate, for more our white parents than for us.
Dan, that's Skylar, one of the adoptees that you talked about. But, you know, we had on Rebecca Carroll of WNYC a couple of weeks ago talking about how hard it can be for white adoptive parents who adopt African-American kids to convey or even think about authentic Black experience when they're raising those kids. And it seems like when adoptive kids come from a completely different culture, a completely different country, that can even add to that.
Yeah, yes. I mean, that's certainly, you know, one of the sort of big points that we got to in this episode was the idea that as much as we like to think that adoption is this sort of fairy tale narrative of a multicultural family that lives together in harmony, and yes, that is often true, but also adoption is inextricably tied to trauma and loss. And it's both of those things at once. And the adult adoptees in our series talk about that, and that it wasn't really till they left home and actually went to Korea and sought out their birth families that they truly understood that.
The new podcast is Your Mom's Food. Dan, did you eat lots of great food along the way making this?
We did. We always managed to somehow work a good feeding into our tapings, Todd.
Dan Pashman is the host of the Sporkful podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts, and the new series, Your Mom's Food. Dan, thanks.
Thank you, Todd.
So how does food connect you to your heritage? Tell us about a dish passed down in your family. We got this from Canton, Ohio. Our Easter Sunday tradition includes a Polish borscht. It's made only once a year and only at Easter time. You make it with fresh sausage, slab bacon, boiled eggs, farmer's cheese, vinegar, and all the ingredients all have meaning and connection to the Christian resurrection. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send your tweets at The Takeaway. And did you catch the music today on the show? All Grateful Dead, All the Time. Happy birthday to Jerry Garcia. He would have been 75 today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.